and welcome tonight to Affair Recovery Radio, Radio to the Power of God, and I'm Rick, and tonight we have the wonderful opportunity of having all four of us in the studio. Dr. John's here.
Hey.
Hey, John, and Leslie's here, and Wade is here.
Hey.
And we're going to be talking about the road to recovery as it relates somewhat to the hurt spouse tonight, but in addition, if you have any questions, we would love to have you guys give us a call. And we actually already have one caller that called in right before the program, Bob. So, Bob, can you join us? Hello, Bob.
Hello?
Are you there?
Oh, hi. How are you guys?
Fine. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I've been better. Who am I speaking to?
This is Rick, and you've got John and Leslie and Wayne all here with us also.
Oh, hi, guys.
Thanks,
hey, Bob.
For calling in,
Thanks
Bob.
For calling.
Where are you calling from, Bob?
Out in California.
Wow. How'd you find out about us?
It was through, I'll tell you my story in a second, but through searching on the website for advice and just searching for answers on something that's been pretty horrific in my life. Do you want me to tell my story?
Love for you to.
It'd be a great start.
Okay. I met the woman of my dreams 15 years ago, and through a courtship, we eventually got married. Within 6 months of my marriage, I got involved with pornography, which escalated into meeting women, which escalated into sex outside my marriage for about pretty much the entire length of the marriage. My wife found out about the pornography years ago and confronted me, and of course I said I would stop, but never got accountability, never took it very seriously, thought I could beat it being a Christian, and of course I was sadly mistaken, and started back into it about a year later, and she then discovered the pornography again, but she didn't know about all the outside relationships, and in a nutshell, God essentially said, if you don't share that with your wife, then you're never going to become the man of God that I want you to be, and I'm never going to heal you of your addiction kind of mentality.
Right.
So I did, and I fought it, because I knew if I did, she would divorce me. And that's what happened. About a month later, she filed for divorce, and that was about almost 6 months ago, which in California, that's about the time for the finality of the divorce to be final. And, of course, in the beginning, I searched everywhere, which is where I came up with your guys' website, looking for answers, looking for understanding, looking for anything. And looking back, I think I took more of the I'm sorry, but also, you know, you should forgive me attitude. And it wasn't until probably about a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, I finally realized that it's 100% my responsibility. It's not her responsibility for me to expect forgiveness. It's more what I've done through this has given her every right to not only divorce me, but I understand completely why she feels so she has to divorce me. And because of the addiction mentality, there's also controlling issues that went along with that and manipulation that went along with it. And she tried. She tried for years, and we went to counseling in the beginning years, but, you know, of course, I never revealed any of the pornography or any of that. And after all this time, she had just, I think she's given up. Well, obviously, she has given up. And she's fallen out of love with me years ago, she told me, and if I have a question for you guys, is maybe some insight into this from what you guys see. There is no hope of, at this point, reconciliation. She never wanted to go to counseling. I think she was just done and just didn't want to give it another try. I've been given all kinds of advice from just leave her alone. Just deal with the kids. We have, by the way, we have three kids under the age of 11.
Wow.
To leave her alone, to, you know, continue to reach out to her, tell her you love her, to write her letters. It's kind of confusing as to my position, and now we finalized all the divorce proceedings. Everything's pretty much finalized now, except for the divorce to be final. And I realize now it's not me anymore that can heal her.
Right.
I thought by sitting down, talking to her, and rationalizing and saying I'm sorry and showing her how truly repentant I am would make a difference, but I realize it's only God that can heal this kind of wounding in a person. And that's hard for a controlling person like me to be in that position.
You know, I know that you probably do get a lot of conflicting advice, Bob, about what direction to go. At here, we believe that the first direction to go really isn't about even trying to save the marriage. I mean, it's really about your soul.
Yeah.
And it really is choosing God over choosing your wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the first questions we ask all of our people is, you know, what's God telling you? And the answer to that question is really important, even more than what John or Leslie or Wayne or I might tell you. It's, you know, you listening and then doing what God calls you to do. Because to me, if there's going to be any hope at some point for the marriage, she really needs to see a transformation. And, yeah. And that comes from choosing God. And hopefully, you know, God will transform you into the man that a man that she could see is really different. But if our focus becomes trying to save the marriage, basically you kind of make her your God. And I think the last thing that women want is I don't think they really want to be the point right now. For you to be safe, it's not about you pursuing her and trying to save the marriage. It's about you pursuing your healing and becoming who God wants you to be. And at that point, if she can see Jesus in you, I think she may begin to find something she could respect in you. That is such a hard situation. I don't know, guys, if Leslie or if anybody here has anything else they want to add.
Well, first of all, I just have to say that I'm so sorry that this is your story. My heart really hurts for you, Bob. I guess one of the things that struck me as you were talking was your need to control. And when I'm working with people, a lot of times I'll talk to them about where's that need to control coming from, what's behind it. Because usually I think behind the need to control is fear. Mm-hmm. And I think as, you know, obviously you have a lot of things that aren't going so well. But I think as you choose to trust God, and maybe even in your fear, ask God to give you the ability to trust Him and let go of trying to fix anything. Because I think sometimes in our darkest hour, we want to trust God, but we really, really struggle with trusting God. And so I will just ask God to give me the ability to trust Him, because if He's called us to do it, He'll enable us to do it. And sometimes we're not asking Him to do everything that we need for us and through us. We're trying too hard to do it on our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, Rick, to your point, I did make my marriage an idol. There's no doubt about it. And even in the process now of these last 6 months, I look back and I realize instead of praying for God to change my marriage, I should have been praying more for God to change me.
Right.
And I hear Leslie, too, just that. And I know the control. It comes from my insecurities from my childhood and my dad not being involved with my life and constructing a wall of no one's ever going to hurt me again. And I developed pride, but it was all a big facade. Because I moved people like chess pieces. I became very selfish. Everything became about me, because if I controlled my world, then I could supposedly, in my mind, lessen the pain. And it's done the exact opposite.
Have you forgiven yourself, Bob?
It's really hard right now, because I've hurt so many people. It's not as if I wasn't blessed with a ton of friends and a great church and an incredible her family and my family. I've hurt so many people, mainly for my wife, to my kids, to relationships going back to college days that we're still close friends with. There's a tremendous amount of shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think the forgiving myself, it's hard. It's hard now. Satan is loading up the shame on me, and that's what he's using to fire the darts at me now, just basically to take the hope in Scripture of, for I know I have the plans for you and the hope in the future, to literally make that complete in question and to realize that for him saying you're never going to have anything as beautiful as your wife again, you're never going to have your kids, nothing in your life will ever be that good again, so it's hopeless.
But that doesn't sound like God to me, Bob.
It's not. I know in my head. I know in my head, but in my heart, because I haven't trusted God in so long, even going to church and being involved with ministry and other things, I haven't ever let that control go.
Yeah.
And I haven't let God really come through, and yet I see him, and I guess it's the old adage of I believe God can work any miracle of the Bible for everyone else, but for me, can he really do it?
Yeah, and sometimes our shame will tell us that, you know, that kind of works for that grace works for everybody else, but not us, because somehow we're worse off, or we've done, you know, our sins are somehow smell nastier than everybody else's. But, you know, present company included here, there's none of us that gets it right. There's none of us who doesn't need grace like that. And don't let those lies of the shame tell you that somehow you're worse than anybody else.
I hear that, and I appreciate that. It's hard because no one in our circle of friends who are all good Christian families and all good people have come close to doing anything like what I've done. And it's just, I mean, literally, it is.
That you know of.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bob, one thing this gig has taught me is if you dig deep enough on people, you're going to find some pretty smelly stuff. And that's just the nature of who we are, you know, and that's why we need a Savior. That's why we all do.
Well, and one of the things that in the recovery work they talk about, we always compare our insides to everybody else's outside.
Mm.
And that's just one of the basic tenets, I think, of working through this, is to forgive yourself and excuse me, to quit doing that, really, you know.
You know, Bob,
yeah.
Go on.
Oh, I feel like, and true, I feel like because my wife, her comments and other people's comments that I have to be a martyr and that I have to feel shame. And I regret everything I've done. I'd give everything in the world to go back, but of course that's not possible. But sometimes when you start to listen to that and look at your circumstances and look at everything that you've affected, it's so hard not to just say, what good will ever come out of this?
Well, and that's where I think sometimes as Christians, Bob, we do this strange thing, and we refer to it as Christian karma. We have this idea that if we do good, we're going to get good, and that somehow we single-handedly have made the biggest mess, that God can't clean up our mess. He can clean up everybody else's. But then there's this strange thing in the Bible, the story of Paul, where Paul was killing Christians. And that seems really, really bad. And Jesus met him on the road. And that seems really good. And so I think a lot of times, in the face of our failures, we begin to understand how big God really is, who we really are, and how much he really loves us. Philip Yancey talks about grace as knowing that there's nothing I could do that would make God love me less. And there's nothing I could do that would make God love me more. That I'm okay. I don't need to be anything. I don't need to do anything. That I'm okay the way I am. But a lot of times we have trouble accepting ourselves, and those around us have trouble accepting ourselves, because we have this idea that if I accept myself, that because I have Christ's life within me, I'm holy, that I'll never change. But that leaves God out of it.
Mm. Yeah, that's very true. There's that part of, yeah, there's that part of you. If you feel like you do good, you're loved more. And I know a lot of what I struggle with, identity, goes back to my father and I and his lack of involvement in my life. And I don't blame him. He had a father who beat him, and thank God he stopped the cycle of abuse with us. But that was my Heavenly Father's view for so many years, and I never let the real God into my life.
You bet it happens that way, and there's probably a lot of men out there listening right now who carry that same father wound that you're carrying, that you're talking about, you know. And I think it's important. Sometimes we draw a distinction between guilt and shame. You know, guilt will tell us that we've done a bad thing, and it's okay to have remorse for that sometimes, but shame tells us that we're a bad person. Shame can be an assault on our very identity, and you can't let your identity rest there.
That's what's been happening, and, you know, the thoughts of just when your wife has said for so long it'd be better if you just weren't here finally start to sink in, and you start to believe that. You start to say, I wonder if, you know, is it better if I just were to go away? And you know, I wouldn't, I know I can't do that, but there's that part about the fantasizing of, boy, what if I just weren't here? What would it really make that much impact? And I know it'd be devastating for my three little children.
Absolutely.
So I know I can't ever do that.
And in some ways, Bob, as you're able to really open up and embrace God and let him heal the wounds that are being uncovered, you can be God's poster child for hope and grace for everybody around you. And I really do believe that.
Bob, the other thing that that I think about is something. Jesus asked two questions in the book of John that I think you need to answer. The first one is, and it's the first question he asked in the entire book. It's, what do you seek? What are you looking for? And you need to answer the question, what are you looking for? And the second one's really interesting, and it was at the Pool of Bethesda when the lame man was trying to get into the water, and Jesus talks to him, and he said, you know, why are you here? And he said, well, you know, nobody's here to help me. People always get in front of me. And Jesus says, do you want to be healed? And I think you need to answer both of those questions. I mean, what are you seeking, really? And do you really want to be healed? Because those are going to be really important questions for you as you work through this thing.
How do you answer the first question when, of course, what I would want more than anything, well, not more than anything, you want eternal salvation more than anything, but I have to admit there's a huge part of me that says I'm looking for my marriage to be restored. And like Job, I argue with God saying, God, don't you understand? If, you know, my marriage was better, my kids would be able to see grace in a new way. My wife would be able to be healed. We wouldn't have to go through this awfulness of divorce. We wouldn't have to go through. And so I argue with God on that level. And so I hear the question, what am I looking for? I guess it's conflicted, and I struggle with, am I looking for just the salvation of my marriage, or am I looking for God to use me in whatever capacity he wants? Because my insecurity tells me my marriage is where, you know, would help me get through this, but I know deep down it's not my marriage that's going to help me get through this. It's only God.
Right. I know that if you read John chapter 1, what the guy said was, we want to know where you're staying. I mean, ultimately what they were looking for was just to know Jesus. And I really feel like any other answer besides that is going to leave you wanting. You know, there are a lot of things in life that are true. It's true that, you know, sexual addiction is really difficult. It's true that, you know, sometimes even affair partners make you feel better than your mate. But if what's true, and it's true that it'd be great if your marriage worked out. But if what's true doesn't end up at the truth, then it's really not the truth. I mean, ultimately, the truth is a person. It's not a piece of knowledge. It's not a fact. It's a person. And I think you start by getting into the truth and rotating and learning more about that person. I mean, what do you seek? I would seek truth. But I think that would be a relationship with Jesus.
Yeah. I guess I'm trying to have both. I want to have Jesus as much as have my marriage, and right now the reality of it is that I know there's nothing I can say to my wife, I think, at this point that's going to change her heart. There's the sorries have been said, the repenting has been said, she's wounded, and understandably so, beyond a point of my own human repair.
And I think that as you find your real security in God, and you don't really have to have your wife's forgiveness to be okay with yourself, that as you find who you are in God, how much he really loves you, and that's your firm foundation, you can truly express the grief over the pain you've caused, which is different than saying, I'm sorry, to fix the relationship.
Yeah. You're right. You know, I know all this in my head, but yet I've never let it come to my heart. And because my marriage became an idol and my insecurities, I've looked at, you know, like where I'm at now. kind of a hopeless part of what's the use going on, because God blessed me with an incredible family, incredible kids, home, friends, and beyond that, a wife that was just more than I could ever dream for. And that's the insidiousness of addiction. It makes you do things that even to people that, you know, nobody should be ever have to go through this, but when you do it to a person as incredible as my wife, it just, there's no logic in what addiction can do.
No, right? And probably the final thing I would say, Bob, before we go to the break here is another thing this job has really taught me is that God does his best work in our broken places. And sometimes it's not the outcome that we're originally looking for, but many times it's far greater than we ever could have imagined that he takes our worst and makes it his best. And we see that again and again. And I just, you know, I know you're confused and really hurting right now, but, you know, just a little plug in there, not to lose hope that, you know, what looks broken and hopeless to us, it's amazing. You know, God's an artist and can absolutely do, you know, literally miraculous things in our lives with that broken material. But thanks so much for calling tonight. And we know that the other listeners out there will be praying for you and your situation in California.
Thanks for your honesty, Bob.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate your hope and encouragement because it's the right, it's the truth.
Okay, hang in there, Bob.
All right, bye-bye.
God bless.
Welcome back to ARC Radio, and during the break, we had a great question come in, which this person made the point that we just kind of blew off all of Bob's things about how to work things out with his marriage, and why wouldn't those things work? Why isn't there a love letter he could write? Why wouldn't roses work with his wife? I mean, why are we telling him to seek something totally different at this point? So, hey, guys, how would you answer that? What would you say to our person that just wrote the question about why did we advise the way we did? Oh, don't be quiet over there. Dead air space.
You're on your own.
I got to ask the question.
Well, and part of the question was, does that ever work? And the answer is, really, it doesn't. The person who has been hurt by infidelity, whatever form or fashion it takes, and actually alcoholism can be considered a form of infidelity, because the person feels betrayed. There's been secrets. There are things that haven't been shared. One of the main problems with the candy, the love letters, the flowers, is the person is still in pain, and they can't respond to any of those things at all because they're hurt. And the other person, the person who's been unfaithful, whatever it looks like, has not necessarily expressed their understanding for the pain they've caused. Bob actually expressed very articulately his remorse, his regret. But does his wife understand or believe that he's beginning to understand what it's like from her viewpoint? Because letters, flowers, candy, dating, when the other person is destroyed, don't help. They just don't.
No, and so often when there's a pattern of betrayals, you know, the candy and the flowers have all been there before. It's always been sort of the Band-Aid that's going to try to make everything okay again. And, you know, they may take a couple times before they really say that there's really not a whole lot of meaning or depth behind any of this because it keeps going back to the pattern again. I think they're instead of that Band-Aid, they want to really be able to visibly see a change in the person's heart.
Yeah, because one of the problems is the person who's been hurt by betrayal isn't going to believe any words that the person has to say. All they can believe are actions.
Yeah, they've heard it all before.
Absolutely, they have.
And the actions aimed specifically at trying to save the marriage will be seen as manipulative and controlling.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So there has to be a whole other set of actions in order to really begin to catch their attention.
Because a lot of times the person who says, I'm sorry, wants the other person to be instantly okay. And sometimes the way we apologize to each other, we say, will you forgive me? Well, that demands an automatic response. And the person who's been hurt whether it's by, you know, a six-month affair, a one-night stand, or years and years of infidelity, is not going to be able to snap back and respond well.
You know, it's interesting. I remember one of my clients who kept trying to help his wife by sending her a dozen roses every day, only to find them bud first into the toilet, stem sticking up when he came home at night, because that's not what she needed at that point. She needed something far more substantial than his roses to begin to feel like something was there. And it wasn't about trying to save the marriage. She just needed to see a new heart condition in him. And that came more through his actions.
Mm-hmm. Because, and sometimes we talk about something that we call pretend normal. A lot of times just trying to fix the marriage is going back into pretend normal. And the person who's been hurt really needs to spend some time in their pain and their grief because they've actually lost something.
So it looks like the West Coast is going to dominate.
Yeah,
the
West
show
Coast is coming strong tonight here.
Now we have Kathy in Oregon. So, Kathy,
yes,
you're joining us. What type of question would you like to ask here at Affair Recovery Radio tonight?
Okay, first off, I don't want to ask a question.
Okay, you can make a comment. Feel free.
That's great.
I want to acknowledge Bob, and I want to tell him how very sad and sorry I am for the situation he's in. Because I'm a wife of a sex addict, and it is it's a journey. And the reason that the flowers and the cards, the love letters, don't work is because the actual pain started long before the affairs, started a long time before that. Mm. When he was looking at pornography the first time, and she told him she had a problem with that. And in some ways, I guess he listened for a year. He didn't listen well enough. Because when his heart is given to something other than his wife and his family, it's betrayal. And if he didn't acknowledge her feelings, then she wasn't important enough to him. And that's how she felt. So her pain started a long time before she found out about all the affairs. So now that she has the discovery and she knows it, she's been living a long time with the suspicions, the being ignored, all the feelings that you get, the loneliness when you're involved in that. And so through that, her pain started a long time ago, and the discovery actually probably set her free in some ways.
Absolutely.
You understand what
you're saying? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Kathy, you're expressing yourself very, very well. I completely agree.
So his letters and cards and flowers and anything and everything that he might want to say right now is just not going to help. What he needs right now is his faith in God, and what she needs right now is her faith, because God is the only one who can walk us through this. There's nothing else, nothing else. I am now on my eighth month of finding out, and, you know, I really do kind of have a hard time sometimes hearing the sad stories of childhood from the sex addict about fathers abandoning them and parents not being there, or their life was hard. Well, a lot of us have hard lives, but we make a choice in this life. And my marriage was not good. My husband cheated on me not very long after we were married, and it continued on. And through all of that, I had suspicions, I had gut feelings, I had stomach aches, I wrote him letters begging him, if he didn't love me, set me free. I would try to talk to him, I would cry, and he'd tell me I was being overdramatic. There was so much, but because of my faith, until I had concrete proof, I couldn't just walk out of my marriage because my husband was, you know, living his life and going to work. And, you know, that was just until I actually had the proof. And then the day of discovery, when the proof came out, then there was a sense of freedom in me, because not only did I not feel like I was nuts all these years, but I felt like I could finally make choices in my life now. Because for years, I had opportunities and choices and things I could have done with my life that I put on hold because I was living my life with my husband and my children. And so my life, I guess, to me, during that, was whatever I did was going to affect them. And so I had to make responsible, good choices for me, my husband, and my children. And then to find out that all this time, my choices were being put on the back while his were just whatever he wanted them to be, left me empty. And so this freedom comes from now I feel like I have the right to choose.
Right. And Kathy, in terms of, anything that maybe we could answer for you or from our experience, would you have any questions for us?
Well, I guess sometimes I hear how people say if the hurt spouse holds responsibility.
Holds responsibility how?
Like I've heard it said that marriage, there's two people responsible in that marriage, which I 100% agree there is. There's two people in a marriage, you're both responsible for its health and its deterioration. But when you're fighting a marriage where you have sex addiction in it or infidelity in it that starts right from the beginning, I try to go back sometimes and go, where did I go wrong?
No.
What did I miss? And I didn't.
No.
I didn't.
No, because, we talk about five different kinds of affairs on our website, and really only one of them is connected to a marriage that has deficits. And I over and over try to emphasize, as I'm working with the hurting spouse, that it's really important to separate the marriage from the infidelity, which I sometimes refer to as the train wreck. Because there are people who are faithful who are in marriages that are not great, but there's a huge myth in our society that a happily married person will not be sexually unfaithful, but that's a myth. Study after study has shown that that's not true. And so even when I think back on my first marriage, I can think, there are things I could have done better. There are things that I wish I hadn't have done. And I will take my part of the marriage, but I'm not going to take responsibility for his infidelity. And addiction is just a whole nother level of that.
Right, right. And I think there's probably one other place. And now my mind just went blank.
That's okay.
Yeah, I just know what happens when you get older.
Well, and when you're on the radio.
Yeah, and you're on the radio.
Happens to me all the time, actually.
It does happen to him all the time.
It's happened to me right now, as a matter of fact.
Gosh, there's so much that goes into this. There's so much that goes into this. And I don't know how anyone can get through anything like this without God. I just don't know how you can do it because I just don't know.
Yeah, Catherine, I was just thinking in my relationship and in my recovery, it wouldn't have made any difference who I was married to. I mean, I'm married to a woman named Stephanie, but it could have been Samantha, it could have been, Janie. I would have done the same thing. And so that's how I know that it really wasn't about my wife. It was about an internal problem that I was trying to fix apart from God. And when my wife wasn't what I wanted, and no woman I could have married could have been everything I wanted, I would have turned to something very different. So that's a difficult thing.
Well, here's a part, I guess, during my marriage before the discovery came out. I did disconnect from my husband, kind of not really emotionally because I wanted that connection, but I did physically. And the reason I did is because I always had that gut feeling that he wasn't being faithful. And I don't know, Leslie, I'm sure you felt that. It's a pain in your stomach that
right.
just won't go away. And I would look at him sometimes and I would think, don't go there. It's dirty. Don't go there. Even though at night I would want to. I would want him to hold me. I would want to be close to him. But there was just something in me that would just tell me not to do it, because I'd already gotten an STD from him early in our marriage. And so I'd back away, and I would pray. Oh, my gosh, I would pray. And I had thought God had abandoned me, because I felt like he wasn't answering my prayers to bring my husband into my marriage. Now, after all of this, I look back and I think God was answering me, just not in my way. Mm-hmm. He was trying to keep me safe.
Right. And he didn't answer you in your way, or perhaps in your time. But I really appreciate, Kathy, how well you've expressed what it's been like for you. And I appreciate your compassion for Bob, in spite of the fact that you're on the other side of the equation. I'm so thankful that you have God, that he's using this in your life.
And well, God's keeping my marriage together.
And Kathy, how did you hear about the radio program?
Well, you know, after my husband brought out, because everything came out real slow for me. I didn't get a wham. He had a 9-year affair, and that's what I got. And then as time went on, I found out there was more. There was prostitutes, and there was other affairs, and blah, 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 blah. And you know how you go back to the first day every time you hear something new. And so I started researching it. All over the internet. I mean, books, reading anything and everything. Just trying to figure out what the heck. How do you get married and then not marry the person you think you're marrying? Not even know this person at all. And I researched and found all sex addictions. So then I started downloading. Went to Carnes and all over the place. And then I found you guys. And my husband's called in and talked to you guys a couple of times. But we listen to you guys religiously every Sunday night.
Well, we're honored.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Well, and I appreciate your sharing your story with us and your time, Kathy.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
You guys have a good evening.
Well,
you too.
Do the same.
You too.
Okay.
Welcome back to Affair Recovery Radio. Tonight, we're supposed to be talking about roads to recovery and the unfaithful spouse and common mistakes. And so far we've been talking to callers, which is actually more fun than what we had planned. So we certainly
absolutely. Thank you guys for calling in.
And the West Coast has been doing so good tonight. I just challenge anybody else on the West Coast to call
yeah.
in.
We need Washington to get that trifecta
actually,
out there.
Actually, I'd say so. East Coast. Step up to the plate.
Either that or Canada's fine on the Vancouver.
But over break, we did have another question that's really a very, very good question. The person asked, you know, doesn't the unfaithful spouse, as a Christian, married to a Christian wife, need to be able to expect forgiveness because that's biblical? And that's a really good question.
I would hope so, because that's the only way I'm going to ever get back into my relationship. I think that this is Rick. I think that the issue with forgiveness is it's so complicated, and partially because I think there are two types of forgiveness. And I don't want to do all the talking here, and they joke about whether John and I can talk the longest without breathing. But so I want Leslie and Wayne to get to weigh in on this too. But there's one part of forgiveness I think that is a vertical forgiveness. It's a forgiveness between me and God. It's the forgiveness, as we say at the ARC, that sets us free. It's a gift we give ourselves so that we can be free from the crimes and the hurts that others have perpetrated against us. And in that form of forgiveness, and this is really in the Christian faith, it's pretty unique, I think, to Christians and not to other necessarily religious viewpoints. But from the Christian perspective, we would say on that vertical forgiveness that we have no right to be offended, that Jesus forgave us, and we are expected in the same way to forgive, not in the sense of we forgive them and God, you get them and give them zits and hurt them, let God do the vengeance, but really to be able to say, you know, Father, I just want to forgive this person. In fact, please don't give them what they deserve. I just pray that, you know, I love them. I pray that you will not give them what they deserve and that you'll have mercy on them, that we come to the point where our heart is so soft toward them before God that we let go of that bitterness so that we can be set free from what they've done to us, because otherwise that bitterness will kill us.
And I would just add that that journey is a journey. It's not an instant thing. Sometimes I think as Christians, we feel like we have to forgive really, really quickly. But that's a process. That's being able to say, this is really what it is. This is what it cost me. This is how it affected me. This whole thing is what I'm forgiving. I'm not just saying it's okay. Forgiveness is not giving the person permission to have done it. It's not saying that this is okay, but it's being able to let go of it, because truly, unforgiveness eats us alive, and as Christians, we are commanded to forgive.
And forgiveness is not a tool to keep someone from doing something again. And so often we think that if someone really wants to save the marriage, that we can almost use forgiveness as a way, or our lack of forgiveness as a way of getting them to stay serious about this, because they can never get back in relationship with us. And I tell you, you do not want to play jailer, because you're the one that ends up in prison if you fail to forgive another person.
But the second kind of forgiveness is a little bit different.
Right. And that one's out of Luke 17, where Jesus says, if your brother sins, rebuke him. Which I find real interesting, because really it's about that person that's done the wrong thing being set right. Out of love, we want to help them get back on the right path. So you rebuke them. If they repent, you forgive them. If they do it seven times in a day and seven times repents, then you forgive them. So for some of the rest of you, so I don't have to hear my voice, what would you say about that horizontal type of forgiveness? How would you define that, guys?
Well, first of all, I would use a different word. I would use reconciliation.
Okay. Okay, there's dead air silence. That's
they have
very
nothing
good.
To say.
I know. I can't believe we've got John and Mike White. Yeah, it's very much about reconciliation, and to me, it's about the ability to see whether or not the other person takes responsibility so that they're safe to be in the relationship again. And that's, I don't know that Jesus calls us to be in a relationship with someone that is unsafe.
Although sometimes he does. I have had clients that it was very, very clear that God was saying stay, even in a relationship with a person who had a sexual addiction who was not in recovery. But unless you hear directly from God, is God calling us to trust an untrustworthy person? Is God calling us to be in relationship with a person who says, you know what, I'm not going to quit this affair. You'll either have to tolerate the behavior or lose the relationship. And I have had clients whose spouse has said that to them. And did the person who was hurt by the infidelity have to forgive her spouse? Absolutely. Was God calling her to stay in that relationship with her husband in spite of the fact that he was really in a lot of ways dangerous to her? Really, it didn't seem so.
Right. And so I think that when you look at it from that perspective, the vertical versus horizontal, or the forgiveness versus reconciliation, both of those pieces have to be taken into consideration when you're dealing with the issue of forgiveness. So we also, on our little list here, guys, I think we had something. Were you going to say something, Leslie?
No.
John?
Well, I think, go ahead and start rolling into what we were going to talk about tonight. We were going to start talking a little bit more about the most common mistakes that the unfaithful spouse makes. And you've heard some of these already tonight from our callers. But the first one is believing that once you and your affair partner have decided to do the right thing and return to your marriage, that the affair is over.
Beep. Actually, the problem with affairs, once you and your affair partner have decided to do anything together, all you've done is co-opted to stay in the affair. That once two people make an agreement, they're continuing the affair. Affairs only end unilaterally. Were you going to add something to that, Leslie?
Well, I was going to say agreeing to end the affair actually increases the intimacy between the two people. It doesn't end it.
Yeah, now we have a covert alliance to continue the affair, so you cannot agree with your affair partner to end an affair without continuing the affair.
Right.
And the number two most common mistake that the unfaithful spouse makes is leaking out information over time. And we heard this one from our caller from Oregon.
Yeah, Kathy actually described how her husband had done that. And one of the things that's so destructive on that one is that the person who's been hurt by the infidelity, every time they find a new piece of information out, they feel like they're knocked back to square one. Kind of going back to the forgiveness, we can only forgive what we know. And when there's a new piece of information, then there's a new cost, there's a new hurt, there's a new layer. And somebody who ekes out information over weeks or months really creates hopelessness in the person who's been hurt, because it's really hard for them to be able to believe it's all out when it keeps eking out.
Yeah, I think that the other piece is that every time you give new information is that start over. And it's like it's difficult to re-embrace. So that's a big one.
Yeah, because when it comes down to it, for most of the spouses who have been hurt by infidelity, it's not what they're forgiving as much as the lies. And so they can forgive a lot of different actions, but it's the lies over and over and over that begin to take a toll on their hope.
Number three, see if we can sneak another one in here. This is a big one, being defensive. You guys ever seen any of that?
Never done it.
Now, defensiveness is a natural reaction when somebody's accused of something, but it's not really helpful under these circumstances particularly.
Right. I can say to defensiveness that someone gave me a really good word of advice when I first went into recovery, which was there were a couple of really safe things I could say to Stephanie when she was right. Even if she was only 5% right, I could say, you're right. When she was wrong, I could say, I deserve that. When she said why, I could say, I'm really praying, because if I give you an answer right now, it's going to sound really defensive, and I don't even know that I know all the answers to the why yet. And I think if you almost come back with other responses other than that, you're going to start moving into defensive land at that point. And it's really about taking responsibility to avoid defensiveness.
Well, and just to tag on to the why question, a lot of times when the hurt spouse asks, why did you do this? The person who's been unfaithful begins to explain the story, when in fact, the person who's been hurt by the betrayal really wants to hear, there's no excuse for what I did. I hate that I hurt you. Because when you begin to tell the story of how it happened or why it happened, it sounds like you're making excuses.
Or that you're blaming your mate for why it happened.
Right.
And I'd like to get to number four if we have time, because that's a really big one, if we can do it in 60 seconds.
Okay, number four, believing everything your mate says.
Yeah, and I put that one in there simply because in an emotional state, your mate will actually say things they may not actually mean. And if you give every word that your mate says 100% credibility, you're going to find out, and you're going to get really confused. And you need to understand that when they are incredibly emotional, we sometimes say things without really running them through a filter of what we actually mean. We overstate to make the point because of the emotion. Help me with this one, Leslie, in case
I
get into trouble.
I was just going to say that angry people don't always speak the truth. Sometimes they speak to destroy and to hurt. And so if your spouse is angry and they're saying terrible things to you, it's not necessarily what they really believe, what they really feel. They may, in their pain, be trying to cause pain back.
Right. And that about wraps us up for tonight. We'll actually move into the other 16 of these maybe next week, but depending on how many phone calls we've got.
But thank you for calling in. We
absolutely
love the phone calls.
Bob and Kathy, God bless you both.